Now, stay tuned for Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, happy Future Tuesday, everyone. This cloudy, cold summer day in Santa Cruz. It'll hopefully burn off tomorrow. I don't think we're going to see anything today.
Siri promised that it would burn off today.
She did. We're going to have sunny weather?
Or actually, it was OK Google. OK Google said it was going to be sunny. So did Sam Quentin. But as he pointed out, it's cloudy here in Santa Cruz today.
Anyway, it's going to be a fun show today. It's summertime. We have people from the outside world visiting us. People from the other side of the country. We are bringing them on the show today because I think they have something to add. Especially Gabrielle, who is here in the studio with us. Gabby, a.k.a. Jungle Girl.
That's right.
Good afternoon, everyone.
From the jungles of New Jersey.
That's the jungles of southern New Jersey, Atlantic City.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here, and I think you're a great asset to the show, as people will see from your insights into some of our stories today.
That's right.
And with any luck, we'll get Gabby to deliver some more interesting stories in the future to the show.
Yes, we consider Gabby a fellow futurist because she is a science wild girl.
In many ways, as you'll see. And also in the studio, we have Tracy on mic number two. Tracy hails from Pennsylvania, I believe. Also a unique Renaissance woman in many ways.
Hello, everyone.
There she is. Okay. And without any further ado, we're going to get into some of the stories with our guests. And in the second hour, we'll be talking to Jungle Girl more deeply about the future of politics. She's deeply involved and has been in that world. Okay, and now this story, I think, also will be of relevance to Gabby. The stories that came out this week about how coffee is far from a vice, that it's actually good for us, that the evidence is pointing that there's all kinds of health benefits to the possible longevity boost that coffee can give us, and that the latest findings that were published this Monday in the Journal of the American Medical Association included 500,000 people, mostly in England and Scotland and Wales, from 38 to 73 years old, who drank 2 to 3 cups of coffee per day and had a 12% lower risk of death compared to non-coffee drinkers during that decade-long study.
Is this a surprise to you?
No. And I believe the study also included people who drank decaf. It didn't matter.
Yeah, what's that all about? It's not about the caffeine.
It's not. There are many compounds found in coffee.
You also had started a company, Boardwalk Beans, I believe.
Boardwalk Beans, yes.
In Atlantic City.
Based out of Pleasantville, New Jersey, which is just outside of Atlantic City. Mm-hmm. We roast personal coffee for people, so our coffee is never sitting around. We roast to order.
So you're more of a ma-and-pa coffee provider?
Yeah, and we do it a little bit differently because we roast outside in a rotisserie, so our coffee is flame roasted. So it's more of the art of coffee roasting rather than
boutique coffee in a way. It's a high quality stuff.
Yes.
Okay. So are you surprised about this study?
No, coffee contains antioxidants. A ton of them. Caffeine is beneficial for us, those of us who aren't sensitive or are too sensitive to caffeine.
Hmm. Well, it says specifically a lower risk of early death.
Well, they just counted how many people drank coffee, and then they counted how many people didn't drink coffee, and then they said, higher percentage of them died if they didn't drink coffee.
Well, let's see. According to
low statistics, I mean, all of a sudden, coffee is good for you.
They said that even people who work around coffee, baristas, the aromatics of coffee are very therapeutic.
The aromatics themselves.
I totally agree. I get so happy when I smell coffee.
Yeah. You know,
they say wake up and smell the coffee.
Right, there's a reason.
There's a reason. Yeah. You got it.
According to this piece, it says coffee has 1,000 chemicals in it.
Mm. Yeah, there are antioxidants and diterpenes, and there's so many components that are beneficial to us.
It brings people joy.
Yes.
He says, think about when you're drinking coffee. Aren't you stopping and relaxing a little bit?
I was just going to say, it makes me happy.
That's exactly what I said. I just love holding that hot beverage in my hand.
Yeah. My morning ritual.
Something about you, Gabby, is that I think you're one of these people that has an extreme awareness of the smell and the taste, and you can actually differentiate between different qualities and different flavors. And
yeah, one of our customers is a chef at a place called the Iron Room in Atlantic City. And when I met him, the beautiful thing that happened was that we agreed that coffee and food were very similar in that you really can't taste food until it's a little bit cooler, till it's not so piping hot and it's cooled down just a bit and it's nice and warm. And coffee is the very same way, where you can really, even as someone who doesn't drink coffee or isn't aware of all the nuances of coffee, you can really discern between these notes, between chocolate and caramel or toffee or nutty notes, berry notes and cherry notes that are found in Ethiopians, you know, and other African coffees. And it just becomes, we brew at close to boiling, around 205 we like. And then we like to drink it at around 170. And by that time, it's just all of those notes really pop. And
how long does it take to cool down?
Just a few minutes.
Never waits because, long enough.
Yeah, we do. Well, at home, I like to do a nice slow drip, a hand pour. By the time it's done pouring, it's usually close to that. You know, it should take about 3 minutes.
Do you actually have a coffee thermometer that you use?
We have a thermometer on our kettle.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The kettle itself.
Yeah, right? It comes built into the kettle, the little gooseneck kettle.
Well, it wasn't considered that long ago. It was thought that people who drank coffee, or it was a vice, is actually considered a vice.
Because it made them talk too much and not smell so good?
Or maybe it's too full of pleasure.
That's right.
You ladies are jumping to conclusions here. I think it had more to do is that those who drank coffee were also very likely to smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yes. Do they also, I don't know, what else do people do? Those indulgent people who drink coffee.
So damned by the company it keeps. Okay. Well, guess what?
Time for a break?
It's just about time.
Okay.
First moment. So, folks, if you've got a little taste and just can't wait to go get yourself a cup, now's your chance. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Dr. Future Show.
Glad to be here.
Me too.
Yeah, good to have you here, Gabby.
Thank you.
So glad you're part of it.
Dr. Future.
Now, we have some interesting news on how our AIs are getting more involved with health advice.
Oh.
You know, our Siri and Alexa and that sort of thing.
And OK Google. Let's call them Siri, good. Alexa, and OK.
And OK. OK Google.
Yeah.
This is
a mini-me called Echo.
That's true.
Those are the ones I know.
Yeah, you can also call Alexa Echo, or you can call Alexa Computer.
Oh.
You can program it to either one of those options, so your little AI can chime in when you say computer, just like in the old Star Trek series.
It's kind of endearing to have your little pet name for Alexa, huh?
I know. It makes it more affectionate, more friendly. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the AIs are considered a disruptive technology in that they'll change the way we do things.
If we let them.
If we let them. Or we might want it that way, too. Like in this case, there's a company called Babylon Health. And it's created an AI that gives health advice, and they have found that it's giving advice that is good as doctors.
Well, they said that AIs are great at diagnosing, that they're able to diagnose more accurately than humans are.
They can study thousands and thousands of charts and images and be able to interpret radiological information very quickly and things like that.
So the very best doctors probably appreciate the help because it makes their job easier. And the very worst doctors are probably in severe rivalry and depression now and trying to tear down the AIs.
Yeah, I imagine that general practitioners are probably in danger, but specialists are probably okay. That's what I think.
It might be the opposite.
I think in the near future. You think?
Yeah, because you know it takes years to train to read radiological charts and exams and looking at MRIs and understanding the intricacies of these images.
But and I mean, if what they would be first instantly, to come in the technology?
Well, okay, here's what they've
done.
But
I think a generalist would be able to expand their range of knowledge, and a specialist would find a whole lot more competition for how many people knew what they knew.
Babylon presented the AI with a sample set of questions testing diagnostic skills, and the technology scored 81% on the exam on its first try. Now, that compared to the average score of human doctors, which was 72%. So it was 81% for the AI, 72% for the human doctors.
Wow, that's significant.
Yeah.
So the AIs are smarter than the doctors? Is that what you're telling me? I'm sure a lot of people would agree, and they don't even know the AIs.
I know. Well, and their AIs are probably pretty much cheap or free.
Yeah, well, how's their bedside manner?
I don't know. I mean, Anthem Blue
Terrible.
Shield was trying to charge as much for an AI house call.
Yeah.
I remember they were trying to market like, hey, you can call and get a free consultation with your doctor for the same price as an office visit. I was like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You're going to charge as much as going to see a real person for something that's a phone call?
Well, they have video calls now to your docs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have services where you can pay like this boutique-y fee and have direct access to your doctor whenever you want. Some of them make house calls.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what it's beginning to suggest, though, is that it might just be as good if you can just hold your phone up over something that's, you know, some growth on your finger or something like that. And the AIs will analyze it for you and maybe route you to potential treatments.
Remember we talked about years ago about being able to do that with plants?
Yeah.
When we were walking around just to have just like to some, like a pen that shoots out some kind of holographic image with like all kinds of data regarding
Yes, and that's the promise of augmented reality now.
Right.
You know, and we're starting to see that. There's a plant app that does that now.
Yeah, it was for, I think it's in French, and I think it was limited to a
specific
region.
Types of French plants?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe wine. Something that has some financial value. In this case, the company also tested the AI against 7 experienced primary care doctors using 100 independently devised symptom sets. And in this case, the AI scored 80%, while the doctors 64%.
Hey, did the AIs design the test, or was that the doctors?
Yeah.
Because, well, you know, maybe they put their thumb on the scale.
Well, they did jump in accuracy to 98% when diagnosing the most common conditions in primary care. So the humans were better on the obscure, weird diagnosis.
Okay, see? And that's where a general practitioner,
you know what to look
maybe
for.
The AIs are better at that.
Mm-hmm.
At general medical information.
That's true. Well,
the humans are better at the harder things.
Right, right.
But the thing is, people put it like it's a contest between humans and AIs, like two sides of the chess game.
Doctors should be using them to help in their diagnosis.
It's really like, we all use Google, so we're all smarter because we have access to the answers to our questions at a lightning speed that we never did before. And we don't have to be specialists and spend a lifetime studying.
It's almost like that. It brings up the spirit of innate competition.
Yeah, we always are doing man versus machine.
Right,
but actually, it's a collaboration.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and as we were talking about in our breakfast conversation this morning, the competition level of evolution and conscious awakeness is actually very low on the scale compared to other forms of consciousness where you're not competing, you're harmonizing.
You're integrating and cooperating.
That's right.
Because togetherness creates the greatest ego of them, the giant ego. You're so alone in your selfish little ego, so why not be with others and have a collective ego?
Well, there's also the fear. You need to have strong.
Sounds like the Borg.
Strong, excellent egos competing to bring out the best in each other. But that is still less of the best than a hive mind or a society of people who are getting the best out of everyone.
Right.
Well, look, even in the richest countries, primary care is becoming increasingly unaffordable and inconvenient with long waiting times. And AI and augmented health services will reduce the burden on the healthcare systems around the world, everywhere.
I think that's because doctors have to spend so much time being business people and not doctors.
There you go. Mm-hmm. For-profit medicine.
Yep.
Such a waste of all that talent.
Yeah, and doctors are notoriously bad business people. That's not.
I think insurance companies, you know, really dug the grave there.
Some hospitals in the U.S. are trying to help patients by putting AI-equipped smart speakers in hospital rooms.
Oh.
So what does that mean? The AIs talk to you?
Yes, when you're in the hospital room.
Like Alexa?
Yeah, like Alexa, yeah.
Does it have information about your medical condition?
Your specific condition?
Yeah, so it can like...
Actually, you do. Yeah, IBM's Watson is taking the lead on this one.
I was going to say, is it kind of like an AI version of Nurse Ratched?
The first prototype.
You better take your pills.
Now, Mr. Smith.
Yeah, you're stuck in the hospital after having surgery. You can't even close the window blinds without a nurse's help. You forget about requesting a blanket to take the chill off or details on visiting hours. You feel powerless. But what if you had an AI there to instantly open the blinds, find out more about your doctor's expertise, or turn up the room temperature, that sort of thing.
Sure, one of those where Siri presents the list of questions for you, like, what would you like me to help with? Here's a list of things you can ask me.
Right.
Because you have to have your mind about you to do this. But you can't do that right now with Siri or Alexa or Google Assistant. They don't satisfy the hospital's privacy and security requirements either. You need a kind of a specialized AI.
That's true.
We have a caller who maybe wants to comment on this.
Sure. Who do we have on the line here, Mrs.
Richard? We have Pete in Santa Cruz. Hi, Pete.
Hey, how you doing today?
Hey, great. Good, Pete. Welcome to the show.
Hey, well, thank you. I was wondering if you recall a few years ago there was a book written, a Checklist Manifesto.
Nope, never heard of it.
It was written by a doctor that kind of described the history of checklists and how they came about. And any one of the chapters was about the medical field, and they had started research because people had gotten so many infections from IVs. When they left the hospital, they had all types of infections. So they were trying to reduce that number, and they did through checklists. But there was something else they found out with their research, that when they decide to go to code red or not, when they decide a patient needs to go to code red, mm-hmm. by developing a checklist, one of the keys, like the fifth, one of the top five keys was a nurse's intuition, that they would spot something that was out of the normal. Something's just not right here. And then they actually gauged the data, and it reduced the number of the people that lived through code red because they got them quicker there. Like, it was something very measurable, 15%, 18%. I can't quite recall. But when I think of AI, I just wonder, is there any way that they're ever going to, like, that human intuition, the experience, is that, I mean, that's the big hurdle I'm worried about.
Good question. That's probably the gold standard. I probably would much rather have an intuitive human than an artificially intelligent checklist.
Yeah, can an AI have a gut response?
Well, DeepMind gets into that, Google's DeepMind. Classically, we were training AIs by more like the way we train humans, with a specialist teaching you knowledge you need to know on specific topics, expert systems they were originally called. But that didn't really work as well as creating an AI that was essentially like a toddler, a child learning. You created the AI coming from a toddler mind. They seem to learn much better that way than as if they were being spoon-fed knowledge. So where they had to figure things out themselves, yeah. Much like we learn, or how kids learn languages. It's important for them to try and fail and see what works.
They're just exposed to it. They're exposed so many times that they develop their own.
Yeah, and they got to figure out the rules, and they've got to have good feedback loops with the environment to know that whether or not what they're doing is successful or not.
That was the one question I always had about AI, and that's why I just thought, you know, what a better place to call, because it's just something that
nice.
It's something I imagine they're probably working on. But
yeah, look at Google DeepMind, and you'll see how these new strategies are being successful.
Yeah, I was just looking at this older article on NPR about the book that he's talking about. And
The Checklist Manifesto, 2009.
Yeah, in 2010, he did an interview. The Gawande is his name. And he was just talking about pilots have a checklist, a takeoff checklist.
It makes it a good way to get things done, right? It simplifies the action items.
Cross your teeth.
Okay, let's look at our action item. What are we going to talk about next here? Should we go to outer space after the break?
We're always in outer space, Dr. Future.
We got a few outer space stories to share.
All right. Put on your safety suit. We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yeah, we have a few outer space stories here. Richard, thanks for that outer space link. Something about a big object smashing into Uranus. But we'll put that into the lineup here.
The gassy planet.
Yeah, what smashed into Uranus? speaking of smashing, there's a very interesting new insight into how our solar system formed this week. It is kind of neat. And it has to do with the asteroid belt. Now, most of you think of the asteroid belt as thousands and thousands of rocks floating between Mars and Jupiter. And that would be accurate. They are. But where did they come from? How did they end up that way? And classically, they've been thought of as leftover remnants after forming all our wonderful planets
right. In
the solar system. And they're the leftover pieces. They're kind of like the Home Depot of the solar system.
Those ones didn't get collected by the local planetary aggregates.
That's right. And it turns out that that's maybe not true. That for years, these leftover planet formations that never quite made it to planet size. Actually, a new study shows that a vast majority of the 500,000 bodies in the inner asteroid belt may indeed be shrapnel from about 5 parent bodies called planetesimals. That there were 5 planets that crunched into each other and created the asteroid belt. The remnants of 5 planets.
Okay, there was a collision, huh?
Lots of collisions.
Many collisions.
Planetesimal collisions. And their tangled orbits were doomed from the start. And they produced lots of fragments and a cataclysmic cascade that's been going on now for 4 billion years. 4 billion years since then.
Okay.
4 billion years ago, which is the same time as when Venus gained its atmosphere and Mars lost its atmosphere. So it was a very cataclysmic time in the inner solar system 4 billion years ago.
Not a good time to be here
on
the planet.
Well, it's interesting. When we look at Saturn's rings and Saturn's moons, they notice that there are moons being formed all the time. And they're formed out of the gases. So you have a non-solid changing, transforming into a solid. It's fascinating.
Maybe that they all came out of that gaseous state initially to create matter. I also found it was interesting that any metal bigger or more complex than iron on the periodic table came from the inside, the explosions of supernovas. And that's quite a bit of material that's required the destruction of other star systems in order for us to exist.
That's a great metaphor for life. It's a literal...
Pretty exciting that we can look back in time and potentially see evidence of the building blocks that built up our solar system. And look at these big planetesimals and them smashing into each other. It definitely tells us something about the circumstances that formed our own planet. How lucky we are that it's stable, as stable as it is. It took a long time to reach that point. The forces, the huge forces that are involved.
I'm reading. It says when these little bodies grow in size through dust that they collect... When they get to be about 1 kilometer in size, it creates this gravitational pull that draws them together.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a magnetism that gets created once they start orbiting.
Exactly.
Is that right?
So collect, then they collect each other as a group.
They attract each other through their mutual gravity.
And then the collision happens through the attraction.
Correct.
Wow. And so,
like some people I know.
Could it be a universal principle? Apply to humans as well? Well,
is it attraction? Is it collision? Is there a difference?
Let's get anthropomorphic here. Superimposition, circumstellar dust clumping. So there's a lot of mystery still in trying to figure this.
So how come do the existing planets do that? Does Earth get bigger or smaller? Why wouldn't it inherently collect space dust and grow in its size?
Anybody out there got an answer?
How stable are we? Well, we've seen it been pretty stable for 4 billion years.
Yeah, what's up with that? I need answers, Dr. Future.
Well, we have a number of people that believe that there are strange planets that do come in from the outer solar system and come ripping by us and then totally mess things up.
Yes.
And then head out again.
That's right. Polar shifts.
And all that kind of stuff. Is this real? NASA says no. NASA says we're pretty stable right now. And that we have nothing to worry about. I think NASA's worried about asteroid strikes on the planet. And that ties into another story that we have about a new asteroid strike detector that's about to come online.
Okay.
And that looks...
That's a comforting thought.
Yeah. I mean, it's... yeah, comforting is, I don't know if it's the right word, Mrs. Future. Considering that a bright flash was of a meteorite hit off the coast of Washington, the coast this weekend.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I got two stories. One, the new telescope, and I'll tell you more about the asteroid strike on Washington. The telescope is just beginning to come online. It's going to be hunting for collisions. It's something that we needed for a while. The U.S. government has been taking the strike consideration more seriously since the Russian meteor hit back in 2013. The Chelyabinsk meteor, it came from a group of near-Earth objects called the Apollo asteroids. Mm-hmm. It was named after the asteroid 1862 Apollo. There are about 1,600 Apollo asteroids logged in JPL's small body database that have orbits, so they cross the Earth's path and are potentially hazardous. And that could be devastating to any region on the planet that gets hit by them.
Hmm. I guess it's a good thing we're mostly water.
Yeah, they're mostly it's going to hit the ocean. Yeah. Yeah. They'll be constructing what's called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST, in Chile, which will be a tool for alerting us of these near-Earth objects. As I said, they estimate currently about 25,000 of them have yet to be found even.
How can they estimate a number if they're not aware of them?
Well, I guess they're aware of the ones that we do see. We think about 90% of them out there. And we look at ones that are 140 meters in diameter or larger, and they extrapolate from there. But yeah, we don't really know exactly how many are out there. And some of them we just discovered days before they impact the atmosphere. Hmm. So it's a significant concern. They could put a dent in our whole day pretty easily if we're not paying attention to this. And certainly they've been connected with mass planetary extinctions in the past, like the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs.
Well, I was always curious about what happened to woolly mammoths when scientists found them in Siberia. They found baby woolly mammoths frozen quickly because they were frozen with fresh flowers in their mouths. So there had to be an event that occurred that created a deep freeze within hours, they said.
You get flash frozen?
Right. How's that happen?
Sudden shift?
Right. I've always thought a polar shift could be the only explanation.
Well, it could be. I think there's also a weather documented phenomenon that happened. There can be really massive hurricanes that displace the cold air of the upper atmosphere really quickly down below.
We see flash floods, so I imagine there are flash freezes.
Yeah, but then it stayed that way.
Yes, I mean? For a long time, right.
Yeah.
In other words, the flood never stopped.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Flash freeze and stayed cold. Yeah, that is weird. Mm-hmm. That it could, yeah, it could be an asteroid strike that maybe triggered something like that. Good thinking, Gabby. If they're on a collision course, though, and we can detect it, we don't have that many options anyway at that point, you know, mm-hmm. right now. And that's the problem. That even if we detect
yeah,
them,
like that old duck and cover movie.
Right. Yeah. What can we do? Move the Earth out of the way? No, move the asteroid out of the way?
Get under your desk.
Yeah.
I'll just hold this umbrella right here.
Make the most of your last day on Earth.
The truth is, no one really knows how well an asteroid can be redirected. There have been several proposals. We've seen a couple movies on it.
Right. Maybe once, if it's in space, then you could maybe push it out of the way. But once it got into the Earth's atmosphere, I think you're like
it's
toast.
I
don't know. The whole idea of trying to push something out of the way when it's big. And, you know, we have a hard time creating something
vibration
that can even get off the Earth. And then once it gets off the Earth, it's really tiny compared to anything it might aim for space.
I hope we can figure it out.
It could be like a giant vibration that ripples and affects the trajectory.
Ah, use the force, Luke.
That's right.
A vibration, you say? Through space? Atmosphere? Zero gravity? Yeah, zero gravity, zero atmosphere environment? Vibration of some sort?
Yes.
Steven in Santa Cruz might like to say something about this, and then we're going to go to a break. Are you guys ready?
Steven, yeah, what do you got? What do you got?
Hi, Steven.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Hi. I just have a question about cosmic time.
Yes.
Do you know how long a Scaramucci unit is?
This sounds vaguely political.
I imagine it's pretty short.
It's 11 days.
11 days.
Oh, that was good.
Ba-dum-boom. Thanks, Steven.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right. Well, folks, it is the hour, the three-quarter hour break.
All right. Got a few more stories for you coming up. Hey, look at that. We got something just came in the email here.
Be right back.
Okay, we played that again because we just got an email in from Mike, who was curious about that song. It's the first time he said that he's ever heard that song, and thanks to that little snippet, it captured him. And now I know where it came from and some of the people who have covered it, but he can't find the version that we played. So I'm here to tell you that that's Mad World by Alex Parks, P-A-R-K-S, on Introduction. Alex Parks, Mad World. Okay, basic lyrics. All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for their daily races, going nowhere, and their tears are filling up their glasses. No expression, no expression. Hide my head, I want to drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. Which is kind of the opposite of us in some ways.
Yeah, that's the world that we like to think of as the past. The world that is not going to have the survivability of the enthusiastic, hopeful, inventive, innovative future.
Hey, Dr. Future.
Hey, yeah.
Hey, Sam.
Sam, how you doing?
I just was wondering, I believe that song is originally from R.E.M.
Yeah, the song apparently has been sung by a few
folks. It's Gary Jules.
Do you think that cover was R.E.M.? Or do you think that cover was...
Well, I'm pretty sure it was Alex Parks, is what it told me.
It's a Tears for Fears song, actually.
That too?
Oh, Mad originally World. Tears for Fears.
Yes, huh. Yes.
I think I stand corrected.
I remember hearing it on Donnie Darko. I think it's in
Donnie
the movie.
Darko? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember R.E.M.
Oh.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I'm glad it strikes a chord.
Consensus,
1982 song.
Oh, you got something on it.
Okay. Okay. Gabby. Gabby right. Stands behind the search algorithm.
Okay, well, I'm glad you like it. To complete on the asteroid thought, there was an asteroid that hit off the coast of Washington coast. A bright flash lit up the skies over western Washington. It happened back in March, and we have analysis of it since then. It landed in the Pacific Ocean off the Washington coast, and now scientists have been searching the floor for this meteorite. It's a massive hunt going on off of Grays Harbor in Grays Harbor County. They've been using weather data and their submarines, remote-controlled submarines, 16 miles off the coast, trying to see what's up with that. The big one is called the vessel Nautilus, operated by the Ocean Exploration Trust, founded by explorer Robert Ballard. So they're optimistic about finding it. They think there are about 2 tons of rock that survived the plunge and scattered across the ocean floor. Hmm. For some reason, they think that rock was particularly important. We shall see. And we know that the asteroids contain all kinds of interesting things. And some of these rocks might even contain thousands of pounds of platinum, which could change the economic value of platinum if something like that was brought onto this planet. And yet it's floating out there in the asteroid belt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's not coming here anytime soon.
Not unless the asteroid miners have their way.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are a number of groups that are trying to mine the asteroids. Mm-hmm. And they're still in the startup phase.
Sure.
But mountains of sodium bicarbonate.
Oh, yes, the sodium bicarbonate. Right. That's another space story today. The strange...
Segue.
A very strange segue to sodium bicarbonate from platinum asteroids. Sodium bicarbonate on the asteroid Ceres. Ceres, which is a very interesting one. It's very large. And
that's
some
C-E-R-E-S,
say...
C-E-R-E-S.
Yeah, it's a frozen ball of water.
It's a dwarf planet, by golly.
Not
don't just call
Mars.
It a frozen ball of water. It makes it sound like a snowball.
A dwarf planet.
It's a dwarf planet.
Planetesimal almost.
Planetesimal.
Survived the planetesimal collisions. And it has more water on it than Earth.
Mm-hmm.
know, which is pretty interesting. One of the things that we have noticed that it had these two very bright spots on its surface.
Yeah, it looked like it was looking out on the solar system.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that there are massive deposits of salt.
What kind of salt?
It's a sodium bicarbonate, I believe.
Oh, sodium bicarbonate.
It's mountains of baking soda.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Mountains. Huge mountains.
Feast your eyes, Oppenheimer.
What do we use that for? Bread?
Bicarbonate soda? For everything.
Do you? Yeah, for upset
cleaning
stomach.
Cleaning the shower.
It does every... It's magic.
Yeah?
Yes. It is.
Give us a few examples.
It takes out odors, stains. You can make volcanoes for children and their science models.
That's right. I used to use that to make things explode, I believe, too. Yeah.
It's magic.
Yeah. You mix that with vinegar, right?
Yeah.
Found massive amounts of sodium bicarbonate. So
all you have to do is get out to the series.
Series, right.
Right.
Turns out
that
it's the
dwarf planet. Right. Pancakes fluffier.
Since it's more easily accessible by the Martians, I think that'll probably be. Meanwhile, let's look at the rest of the space news. Big news from the astronomers this week was that they were able to observe for the first time a planet forming.
A planet forming.
Yes. A birth of a planet is captured for the first time. And it's a gas giant that was being born. It's a huge gas giant, many times the size of Jupiter, swirling to existence. And it is happening a mere 370 light years from us.
It seems relatively
practically
close.
In the neighborhood.
Yeah, well, it's in the galaxy. The theory of how gas giants form from a vortex of hydrogen and helium molecules captivated by their own gravity is now widely accepted. But it was never seen before until now. And there were scientists at the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg at the very large telescope in Chile for the European Southern Observatory where they were able to see this spectacular image of the birth of a planet. And we have a link to that on
our
webpage.
How do we know when to celebrate a planet's birthday?
Well, I guess when...
When it goes from...
I mean, is it like when it cools down below 1,000 degrees?
When it's called a planet.
Yeah, when it actually forms a solid.
Yeah, but this is a gas giant. It's bigger than Jupiter. We don't even know if there's a solid in the middle.
Well, that's true. But there has to be a core, no? Is it just gas?
Well, that's one of the mysteries.
When does a planet become a planet and not a cloud of gas?
It sounds like a song. Yeah, like... When does a planet
become a planet?
All right, but anyway, so
when exactly did the Big Bang?
We're watching a planet be born, and that's teaching us a whole bunch of new ways to understand how any planet is formed.
Yes, yes.
We're seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, we have a very nice picture of the planet forming. Maybe it's not a planet yet. Maybe it's still a planetesimal.
Yeah, right.
But it's being formed.
Maybe the planetary system is still pregnant.
But these timings are huge, right? I mean, it might take billions of years for it to
form. It's always knocked up.
Yeah. But when exactly did the Big Bang end? That's what
I
want to
know. It has not ended.
Nope.
This is it.
Still going on?
We're it. This moment.
The front end of the Big Bang?
Still the Big Bang. Yep.
Woo!
Okay, well, I'm happy. I'm happy with that. Here's another interesting thing to consider. NASA, they have a contamination police. They have a new division, a planetary protection officer in charge called Lisa Pratt. And she oversees major shifts in regulations regarding what we send to space.
Hmm.
And the idea is that when we launch something from Earth, it has a lot of microbes on it.
Yes.
Right? There's billions of them on your hand.
Yeah, so when they sent the Mars rover over, that was...
There's still some on it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And so now they're thinking, well, do we do that, we might contaminate other planets.
Yeah, or create things, if you're trying to study something, you want to make sure you're not contaminating it.
Oh, that's right. You want to hopefully, that's my own fingerprints I'm looking at.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
looking for signs of life, turns out it's us.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, and space, though, it's not exactly the lawless Wild West. It is kind of close to that.
It's like firewood. When you go camping someplace and you want to build a fire, you're supposed to get local wood because you don't want to bring in other organisms.
Which have microorganisms in them, which will affect the microbiome of that ecosystem.
Yes.
et cetera, yeah. So how do we avoid potentially harmful interplanetary exchanges?
Well, you got 1 minute to tell us.
These could spark virulent epidemics on Earth or wipe out fragile early alien biospheres.
Yeah, it's a serious thing.
So this forward contamination of other worlds, if we're trying to stop it with the people that look for alien bioactive molecules and look for Earth molecules that might want to live on other planets.
So instead of homeland security, we have home world security.
Yeah, that's a new division of NASA starting to track that kind of stuff. That you'd like to know.
Okay.
Like the Tesla that Elon Musk sent up, they don't think it was properly decontaminated.
Oh, gee, you think?
So are they
going to send crashes on Mars,
an intergalactic
Tesla
cop?
Microbiome germs on Mars, and we're in trouble now.
Somebody's going to give him a ticket.
Yeah. Yeah, so stay tuned.